It's Wednesday, February 28th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 41 of Fear the Booth, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 56 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and on the mics with me is Chad.
Howdy.
John.
Hey.
Adam.
Hi.
And Mike.
Hello.
Take 23.
But let's get down to the important point that we're going to get on take 23. Adam, you did what while playing Wii Bowling?
I threw my back out. I went over to my parents' house for Christmas, and my brother had just come back, and he brought his Wii with him. And I was like, this Wii thing, well, it looks cool. Oh my God, there's bowling? A true St. Louisan. So we bowled for like 6 hours, and then like as soon as I took my hand off the remote and laid down, it's like I couldn't get back up. My back hurt so bad. It was awesome.
Yeah, I would laugh at you, but I played Galaga down at the Coffee Cartel downtown last night, and I can still feel it in my arm 20 hours later.
Oh, yes.
I think it gives you a shot count of how many times you've hit the damn fire button at the end of a game over, and mine was approaching 2,000.
Wow.
It's amazing.
How many quarters?
Just one credit.
Oh, wow.
I made it to like level 18 or 19. I'm a Galaga god, dude.
Yeah, I've seen you. It's amazing.
So Coffee Cartel has Atari in it now?
No, it's got the Namco 25-year Ms. Pac-Man Galaga machine.
Nice.
Have that with a game of pool and an Irish coffee, and you're good to go for a Friday night.
The only game Chad and I have ever got that from, there was an old Atari 7800 game called Ball Blazer. And this game...
Did it blaze your balls?
It blazed your balls in a way you can't imagine. It's a simple game. And if nothing else in my life, this stands as proof that fun does not have to equal complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes it can't. Sometimes complex things are more fun than simple things. But there are simple, fun things in life. All this game consisted of is each of you has a little hovercraft that you're kind of looking out the front of. There's a ball that bounces around this little playing field. You can capture the ball on the front of your hovercraft, basically just holding it there, and then all you do is try to drive it to the other end of the field, shoot it through these goalposts, while the other player is trying to ram you in such a way as to knock the ball loose, at which point they get it, and now they can run to the other end of the field and try to shoot it.
I hate getting rammed when I'm trying to set my balls in order.
And while I can't argue with that point, by the time that Chad and I were done playing this game, from gripping that controller so tight, because these games were intense.
Yeah.
And we would be gripping those controllers so tight.
And we're talking the old classic Atari, perfectly ergonomic stick controller, too.
Yeah, exactly. The Carpal Special. And by the time you were done, you had to call 911 to open your hand again.
Yeah, they need to get the jaws of life to pry your fingers off that thing.
It would hurt for hours.
Yeah. Mike, any video game injury stories from you?
Can't say I've ever been hurt playing video games.
Then you are not a
You haven't played
game.
Them hard enough.
My shoulder a little bit from repetitive movement, but that's about it.
Mm.
That's a start.
Your shoulder?
Yeah.
No, video games.
Oh, that's terrible.
Chad.
Video games. You know, the mouse. When you're up there, the way I have to lift my arm up and whatnot, the repetitive movement sometimes of playing World of Warcraft and stuff.
I have to get a...
Dude, you need to reorganize your desk.
Yeah, you need a tab, dude.
I know.
I had to get one of those little gel blobs.
Oh, I got one of those. On. One of those boobs. Yeah. My wrist is fine now forever. Yeah.
Those boobs.
Yeah.
That's what they are.
Little fake boob, little silicon-filled pod that... Is just the right size.
I actually
size.
Think I did see a mouse pad that had those gel things that was shaped like a pair of breasts.
Really?
Yeah, I've seen one.
At least they weren't against mine.
Anyway.
I think we have something new for the Fear the Boot store.
I think we do.
Fear the boobs.
Now, whose picture are we going to put on them?
Oh, yours.
I know. It's a hypothetical question.
Well, speaking of boobs, there's a couple of things out there that Fear the Boot would like to thank.
Boobs.
No, actually, in all seriousness, there are a couple of people we would like to thank. And I would like to comment, and I think we have said this on the show before. I don't know if we have or not, so bear with me while I say it again. That when we kicked off the show, I fully expected that walking into the podcasting community, we were going to face a lot of tension, a lot of competition.
I was looking at a hail of gunfire.
And I figured, you know, these are people out there who really love their hobby, who are going to be really jealously guarding their fans and we're going to have all kinds of problems and people defacing our website, or I'm going to have to be trying to get iTunes to delete ugly comments about us, or who knows what.
Or at least no one would listen to us at all.
But it has been 180 degrees in the opposite direction. The community of gaming podcasts has been the most supportive, the most helpful, the most compassionate group that I have ever in my life been involved in. I mean, these are just genuinely good people that love the hobby, love podcasting, and love helping other people do both. We, throughout the course of the show, have thanked a bunch of different people who have helped us along the way. We've thanked Mick over at Harping Monkey. We have thanked the guys over at DLI. We've thanked a bunch of people. But there's a couple that we specifically want to thank today. The first of those is the guys over at Pulp Gamer. They are a podcast that has been around a fair amount longer than ours. I'd say a lot longer, and it is a lot longer, except podcasting is still fairly young. So by a lot longer, I mean about a year. And the other is the guys over at Accidental Survivor, which is a much younger, these guys are like on episode 6 or so. It's a D20 modern podcast that's done by one of the guys from Sword's Edge, and I'm not sure if the other folks involved in that are also from Sword's Edge. But both of these shows recently have been giving us a lot of good positive press. There's great people behind them. And so if you guys are looking for other gaming podcasts to check out, don't hesitate to give these guys a try. And for that matter, don't hesitate to give any gaming podcast a try.
All of us, all the people who do the gaming podcasts, it's not like any of us are pulling in big dough or really getting anything out of it other than just the love of communicating our ideas and the love of just expressing our feelings towards the hobby.
And my love of my own voice.
Well, there's a reason
why. At least one person then.
There's a reason why on this show, Fear the Boot has a ton of negativity, and you will hear us.
Yes.
You will hear us bitch about everything, but you will never, have never, and will never in the course of this show hear us talk smack about another podcast.
Except ourselves.
Yeah, except ourselves.
Except the Fanboy Smackdown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fanboy Smackdown's
that Tony guy?
Crap,
oh my
and nobody
God.
Can stand Tony.
Movies? Who watches movies?
Yeah. You'd have to be an idiot to have him on your show doing a D&D movie review.
Yes, you would. Or drinking scotches with him at that one place.
Yeah.
Oh, scotch!
Yes, scotch! That's right.
By the way, there's another podcast you should check out sometime, Fanboy Smackdown.
Yeah, Tony's a great guy. Actually, they just got picked up by a podcast network that includes Slice of Sci-Fi. It's a pretty big deal. I couldn't tell you the name of this network off the top of my head because I don't keep up with that any better than I do the role-playing industry.
Congrats, Tony.
But yeah, Tony, you got it picked up by something pretty good. You know, something else I'd like to talk nice about, to talking smack about.
Oh, dude, we got to do something negative.
We'll get there. Believe me.
It's a long road.
Looking down a couple lines on the show outline, we have World of Darkness, so we'll get there. Just be patient. But something else I want to talk good about is the guys over at Geek Label. I love what those guys put out. They've also been extremely supportive of the show and all kinds of stuff in the community as a whole. And even though we were not able to use them for the Fear the Boot store, just because, of, as we described in a previous show, because of some printing issues, which really we kind of regret. We wish we could have used them. They went ahead and sent us anyway a set of hoodies that have the Fear the Boot compliant logo on them that they just printed up. And these are pretty nice articles.
They are. I'm wearing mine right now. It's comfy and stylish.
And it's fuzzy on the inside.
It is fuzzy on the inside.
I think they actually just kicked off a hoodie line, which is what this is sort of announcing. Mm-hmm. So if you're ever looking for little shirts and such that have smarmy gaming logos and stuff on them, check out the Fear the Boot store, but also check out the Geek Label store, because they got some stuff over there. And if this gush seems so out of character for this show, it really is, but
this is our wild 40th episode. Whoa, yeah. We're being positive. You're this right. 41? It is an episode 10.
No, it's 41.
Oh,
you guys just missed 40.
It's such a wild episode. 40.
We were drunk. We couldn't have spoken.
Boobs or fat dorks?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what did you end up seeing?
A yip.
Let's move on.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I cashed out. That's your problem.
You know, one thing that I think these gaming podcasts do, why it's important to support these gaming podcasts, is because of the fact that they right now are one of the big driving forces in bringing people into the community, organizing the community, keeping people interested in gaming.
Keeping people informed.
Yeah, keeping people informed.
And providing.
And misinformed.
In our case.
When they listen to us.
And also providing places where the community can gather. Not just our wonderful Fear the Boot forums, but also the other forums. Beyond forums, too. I know that a lot of the other podcasts get a lot of feedback, and then they share that feedback with their listeners, too. So that's another way that people stay connected.
Let's get back on track for the show. Let's talk about something disappointing, and then let's move from that into World of Darkness.
Is there a movement there?
That'll be an easy transition. I wanted to do a quick comment on the Skies of Glass resource documents, because you guys may have noticed that this is episode 41, and episode 39's may or may not even be up yet. The reason for this is because we...
Dan is lazy.
I am super lazy.
He made 70 on WoW, though.
I just sit at home with a straw hat over my forehead, sleeping beneath a tree all day, specifically a maple tree.
Did you make 70 on WoW?
I did.
Grats!
Well, thank you.
I did last night as well.
Yeah. Actually, I made it right about the same time you did.
Cool. You guys have no life in that jealous way.
6 weeks to make 70 is not a big deal. People that were making 70 after like 20-some odd hours.
That's
pretty sad. But with the SOG resource documents, we obviously release these shows on a weekly basis, and that right there is the primary thing that we are trying to pace. We try to make sure that the shows come out on time, that we have 1 hour worth of material, and that we never slow that down. The unfortunate thing is the resource documents don't fit that model, because we may have, let's say, half an hour of advice to say about a particular subject, and that document may be a page long, or it may be 50 pages long. But either way, that show comes out with its hour length, half an hour of advice, and next week the next one has to come. And that's exactly what has happened with the show. We have gone through material on the show faster than I can possibly prepare the documents to release to you guys. So all these resource documents are coming, but it's just an unfortunate reality that because the show is moving faster than I can write what in some cases are turning out to be 20 and 30 pages straight of type material, I just can't keep up with that. And I really am not going to try because I don't want to burn myself out or run myself into the ground.
Our solution to this? We're going to have 10 straight episodes of fluff. We're not going to talk about anything. No. We're just going to kind of babble.
That's right. Starting with episode 41 all the way through episode 50, we are just going to completely jack around on the mics. We are going to...
We might have another Candy of Australia episode.
Even better, we're just going to watch TV and comment on it. The other thing I wanted to say about these Skies of Glass documents real quick is I wanted to make a clarification that no one has called us on yet, but I just want to be sure everyone understands. We have not pre-written Skies of Glass, and we're just releasing it in tidbits as we talk through it on the show. Skies of Glass is a game that we had envisioned before and had created certain rules for.
And we've played it before.
But we threw all of that out the window, and we are starting this over. We are releasing these documents as we write them. So we do an episode, we talk about writing a particular kind of rules because we just got done writing those rules, and then we try to prepare a resource document and release it. So if you look at this and you're like, wait a minute, this doesn't seem quite complete, or this doesn't seem play-tested, that's because it isn't. These are object lessons about game design. This is not supposed to be a polished, finished product that you could put on your shelf and play with your friends for years to come.
Yes, right. This is as much about the process as it is the product. We are falling down when we try to walk and puking on you. It's all cute. You know, it's a baby. Just take it.
That's disgusting.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
I did like the movie Falling Down, though. That's as far as I got.
That was a good one.
I was caught up in a moment.
Now you're
going
to die with that stupid hat on. Michael Douglas.
This is uncanny. I was just thinking about this movie earlier today and how I haven't seen it in a while.
We need to have a Falling Down episode. Episode 42.
If you have driven on an interstate, shopped at a store, worked at a job, you have thought about falling down.
Oh, hell yeah.
Even if you've never seen the movie, you have thought about falling down.
You've thought about throwing it all away and going on a rampage.
Actually, we do have something like that to review of. Chris Husty sent us a, from what I understand, a play-by-click DVD-based D&D adventure.
Ew. Oh, my God.
It sounds horrible.
I love Chris Husty.
But this sounds horrible, and this sounds like a bonus episode.
DVD-based? Oh. What is this, a LARP?
I'm seriously hoping.
It's a choose-your-own-adventure book with DVD menus.
You know how they do DVD games on some movies?
Yeah, like DVD board games and stuff.
An entire DVD, nothing but games.
Now, truth be told, I really don't exactly know what it is because haven't played it yet, but this is going to be a bonus episode.
Comedy gold.
I'm seriously hoping his wife sent some baklava in it with him.
No. I was worried he made a game and was playing this LARP and taped it and sent it to us, and I really don't want to watch anybody do some LARPing.
No, that's not what this is at all.
Okay, that's good.
I just wanted to put on Odo makeup and arrest me.
Throughout the running of this show, we have gotten feedback on a couple occasions where people have kind of asked us, I guess categorically, what I would describe as being the outdated nature of the show. in that pitch. We talk about topics that are fairly universal. Chad was pointing this out earlier, that the topics we talk about are, they're concept related. How to GM, how to play, how to run a game. These are ideas that are independent of the gaming system. They're the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I mean, assuming we're not talking about some weird new breakthrough gaming idea.
But it's helpful like to have the current stuff. It's helpful to know the current stuff so that you can relate to your audience, though, because a lot of newer players don't know what Shadowrun or Battletech or Star Trek.
Well, there's also I envy them.
There's also people out there that are just big fans of a particular game system or even writing their new ones, and they're just kind of peeved that all we talk about on this show is games that have a copyright date somewhere around 15 years ago. So
I personally don't see that as a problem.
Well, let's at least explain why it is. We had our what I call our golden age of gaming when we bought the most gaming products and spent the most hours per week gaming back in the mid-90s. And this is when, quite frankly, a lot of the big games either ceased to exist or went to hell. It was at this point that we just kind of gave up buying the products. There was nothing out there we wanted to buy. So we just started writing our own games and playing the old ones. And old habits die hard, even today, as there are some games out there that are probably pretty good. We still just write our own new games and play the old ones we have sitting on the shelves. This show would probably benefit from having some examples of games that aren't that outdated. So, Mike, you have graciously taken on the task of bringing the show up to date. And to kick that off, you have gone out and picked up what game?
I picked up World of Darkness after I was looking at Nobilis and a little bit of Call of Cthulhu.
You know, what edition is it they're on now?
37.
I caught Witch in 37.
For which game?
World of Darkness.
World of Darkness.
Oh, God, I don't know. Third, maybe?
This does out third. Everything else is at third.
D&D's at third, so why not the third?
Well, I do think it is the third, because I can remember the old books that I have, the Vampire, the Masquerade, Werewolf, the Apocalypse books. I think that was second.
So, okay, so we don't know. This is third edition,
maybe that was
fourth
first,
edition.
I don't know.
I don't play any of those games. I make up my own.
We're talking about the 2004 World of Darkness books that just, you know, that are on the shelves right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, having picked up this brand new product, what do you think of it?
Good stuff. But I like the horror games, that those kind of dark games, which are setting heavy and story heavy, of course. And I like that little element of horror. And
now, there's a lot of people who don't like them.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
There's a lot of people, because from what I understand, what people have told me is that they have pretty much nuked their whole plot line, their whole plot arc.
You don't mean horror movies, horror games people don't like. You mean World of Darkness, the new game.
Yes, World of Darkness. And they say that they don't like what they've done with it. They don't like the direction they take it in it. They don't like how they have all these characters that they play and all these plots they run that are tied to the old plot line. And now they've completely changed it. And
you know, though, someone had a poll going on our forum, and obviously this isn't like a statistically accurate examination of the gaming community or anything, but I thought the poll on our forum was going heavily in favor of the new World of Darkness.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people who like it, too. And I have found, from all the people who tell me about it, pretty much divided into two camps. One are the people who've never really played World of Darkness, and they're just picking it up. So they can't be disappointed. They don't know what the old system was like, and they like the new one good enough. And then there's the people who just don't mind it. They think that the old system just, not system, but I'm talking the story arc and the characters and plots and stuff, it just got too convoluted and it was getting too weird and they were just piling stuff up and it just wasn't that well written. And the new one they find is a lot better written.
Change is always hard for characters. Give me a system.
You know, it's something that I've heard talked about with other games, where they've said that at some point they almost half reset the plot line, because as you add novel upon novel, source book upon source book, the game is dangerously unapproachable to a new player, because there is so much to learn. They just feel absolutely overwhelmed by it, like they can never really be on the inside of that.
That's the D20 argument there. It's like, why do you need any system? Use D20, because everybody already knows it. Nobody has to learn a new system.
Well, that's for the statistics, but I think, Dan, you meant more, there's 500 major NPCs. There have been 12 wars since the last module came out.
Oh, I get
and
that.
And you don't know it, so you can't roleplay a character in the universe because everyone knows it.
I get that with Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, I do too. I was going to bring that up exactly. Dan, you ran a very, very streamlined Forgotten Realms. I still didn't know left from right.
Yeah.
I didn't either. That's why I ran a streamlined.
Okay. Not so dumb then.
Yeah, that's another one where it's like, well, what era are you playing in? Well, when did this happen? Well, are these characters dead? Well, let's go to this city. Well, wait a minute. What age is this again? Well, that city isn't here, or that city doesn't like you. Well, that's changed. And I don't know. I mean, I think that systems or games that have real big, heavy stories that have gone on a long time are really cool. But then again, I also see advantage in just, okay, let's start over. Well, you know what? Now that I say that, I don't really like the idea of starting over. If you're going to start over, just make something new. You should be creative.
Yeah.
I think that taking a system or a story arc that you have that works, that people like, and just saying, well, this doesn't work for us anymore. We think we can make it better. Well, take all that creative energy and make something different, new.
So, Mike, with this New World of Darkness book, if I understand it right, it used to be you went out and you bought basically your monster. You bought a vampire book. You bought a werewolf book. You bought a mage book. You bought a fairy book. But you're telling me with this New World of Darkness, there's like one core rule book, and then you add on the other...
Well, there's the World of Darkness book kind of has the rules for the game, but then there's Vampire book and Promethean book and lots of different books for if you want to play one of the bad guys.
So it's still a choose your own monster.
It is, books. And if you wanted to buy all of them, you'd be spending a small fortune.
So what do you personally think of the new backstory in this?
I like it. I like horror games in general, and games like Ravenloft are hard because you're having fantasy horror, which... Yeah, that's pretty hard to pull off. Whereas the modern sorts of stuff like you can do with Call of Cthulhu and with World of Darkness, I get into that a lot. It's just really hard to game master that stuff, and it's very hard to, well, it's hard to game master it well. So I'd love to find a good game master for World of Darkness, but, you know, Dan's a good game master, but you're not, of course, familiar with the rules. And so getting up to speed and everything with everything else you've got going on would be a challenge. And it'd be really hard to game master it well, especially if you weren't familiar with the setting and the rules.
And but I do think like you've ever done horror, have you, Dan?
Yes, sort of. I've never done a setting that was intended for horror. I have run horror games before that actually went pretty well. They're hard to do. They're very hard to do.
Yeah,
they
I've are. Never even tried. It looks very, very tough. I would probably just go ahead and abduct Eye Tyrant and make him run my game rather than learning how.
Oh, did you read that story where he's like, he turned out all the lights and he was doing all that stuff for the players?
Yeah, I hear he's really good at it.
Yeah.
Eye Tyrant, if you're good at World of Darkness, man, I want you to run me a campaign.
Eye Tyrant is a forum user, by the way, for all those people who aren't on our forum.
He's also an optometrist.
He's the greatest optometrist in the universe.
Because
the
gaming discount.
And the man can party rocks. Like no
oh
other.
Oh, my God.
We're going to find out for sure. We have a party going on tonight. We're going to find out for sure.
We know. We're going to take notes.
We will learn from him.
Bring your video cameras.
Oh, yes.
No pictures.
You know, hedging off something you said there, Mike. You were talking about how it's easier to run horror in a modern game than a fantasy game.
Yeah.
And that got me thinking about something else, which is, why is it that people are more accepting of non-realism or absurdity, so to speak, in a fantasy game than in a sci-fi game? Because in a fantasy game, let's take D&D, nobody really has any problem with the idea that you have a sword that can cut through stone or that you can stab someone 100 times before they die. But if you try to bring this into a sci-fi setting where someone has to be shot 100 times before they die, everyone's rolling their eyes, and it starts to kind of drag from the game. But why do you guys think there is that sort of disconnect?
Well, there's several reasons. For one thing, we live in the modern age, and imagining the fantastic happening right here in front of us where people are flying and bullets are bouncing off of you just doesn't happen. The past we're disconnected from because we're talking hundreds of years ago, so that's one reason. Another is the introduction of magic and fantastic creatures which already exist in fantasy. If there's dragons and people hurling fireballs, why isn't there more, you know, bizarre things out there? I think that's why.
So do you think that if we just pretend that the Earth had fantasy in it and there were dragons flying about and people hurling fireballs, that people would be playing role-playing games where they played normal people?
Maybe so. Maybe so. Or more fantastic, more likely, more fantastic creatures.
People. I'm sure they'd screw it up. I saw a webcomic about a World War II film that was made 2,000 years later, and it was like Nazi knights charging the field against British tanks, and this biplane shooting down a jet.
Interesting. Out there,
I'm sure we're destroying it just like they are, or will be.
I think part of the problem is that with science fiction, you're trying to emulate a reality that could be, it's just that we haven't gotten around to it yet. With fantasy, I mean, no one has ever tried to explain magic. People just accept it.
Yep. I think Mike's onto something, though, that our context in the modern world makes sci-fi demand more realism. Because I've heard that in art, one of the hardest things to draw correctly is the human face. Because of the fact that subconsciously the viewer is the most aware of what a human face looks like. If you draw a tree and it's a little wrong, probably no one's really going to know that. If you put the wrong kind of leaf on this particular tree or have the branches growing the wrong way, no one's even going to realize it. But you draw a human face wrong, even just slightly distorted, and the people that are looking at it see that. And I also wonder how much this is just a balance issue, that if you live in a world where one guy can throw fireballs and there's a dragon out there, I guess the question is, so what does the knight get? The answer could be, well, valor and bravery and such, but the truth is the knight's valiant
and written character?
Well,
God forbid.
The knight's valiant and brave because the fact that the 100 men that tried this before him failed, but you don't want to go through 100 characters before you get one that lives past the first adventure. So you just accept.
And it's easy to be brave in the armor, which, much like the fireball that shoots like a howitzer, can stop 1,000 daggers because they don't have enough pluses behind them to puncture it.
Well, you can have a well-written character that's a mage, too.
Oh, absolutely. Just
you can have a well-written character that's the combat master as well.
Hey, real men wear cloth.
That's right.
Putting that on the table.
And they roll method one. I don't see any of you bums rolling method one anytime soon.
I would roll method one if everyone else in the game was doing it.
Adam and I do it every time.
I would love to even do it the old D&D way where you roll straight down and then you get...
That is method one.
Then you get to see what your character can be based on those attributes.
You don't have 9 strength? Can't be a fighter. Don't have 17 charisma? Sorry, the Holy Order of the Paladins doesn't want you. You'll be a bard with your 15. Hope you can play the lute. And Moses said to Israel, roll for initiative.
Oh, actually, speaking of Moses rolling for initiative, that DVD we got from Chris, he said that it has the characters from the player's handbook in it. Like, Mealy and all
that. Oh, yeah, the novels have them in them, dude.
Do they really? Yeah, I did not know
Mealy,
this.
Mealy, Josin, Tordek, and, who's the damn sorcerer? Hennet, you're not going to get me twice, Hennet. I remember you this time. That's the party. That's the four of them.
I can't wait to do this kind of ridiculous crap for Skies of Glass. We're going to have pointless example characters we will bring up again and again in novels and DVDs and finger puppets and all the other things where it can pop up books.
Oh, my God, a Regdar finger puppet. Yes.
The gaming advice topic for today is on designing combat for your role-playing game. So all of you that have been holding your breath, you can finally let it out. We are ready to talk about combat.
I myself am going to leave because I never use this stuff.
You don't need to leave because that's next episode. We're going to spend the rest of this episode.
Dan, let's go get your guns out and stroke them while we talk about how to fight in a role-playing game.
I'm okay with that. I can bring one of them down here for you to hold.
Can I have the AK?
Yeah, actually, yeah, if you want, I'll actually get that out for you
later. Dude, I
want
to hold it.
Okay, we'll do that after the podcast is over. As we were talking about designing the combat system for Skies of Glass, we were trying to think through some of the decisions we were having to make and some of the issues that were coming up, and then also comparing that back to the role-playing games that we are most familiar with, and looking for some kind of rules or consistency in there that we could pass along to you guys. And I'd like to start with the model for combat, because most role-playing games, just like the character sheet with attribute skills and gear, most combat systems seem to follow a pretty consistent template, which is, first off, you roll initiative. There's 6 people in a room, 3 of them want to kill the other 3, you first roll to see who goes first. Second, whoever is going first gets to attempt to execute an attack. Third, you determine whether the attack hit. Fourth, how much damage it did. Fifth, whether armor changed that damage. Sixth, you hurt the person.
Armor, of course, being the wild card, it can be anywhere between positions 2 and 5.
Yeah, because in D&D, armor is used to modify the hit. In some other systems, it reduces the incoming damage, so it depends on your system. But armor out of the picture, the rest of the combat system is all pretty consistent. And like the character sheet, we wanted to take that back to concept. So we sat down and said, all right, do we think this combat system, this basic template everybody uses of initiative, attack, roll, damage, really works? And honestly,
yes, it does.
Yes,
for ranged combat in particular, we couldn't improve on it. It's pretty much the way it is. If I've got a gun and Adam has a gun and we want to kill each other, one of us pulls it out first, one of us fires, one of us either hits or misses. And if we hit, the one who got shot takes some kind of damage. It's pretty straightforward. We wanted to take it back to concept and improve on it, but I don't really know that we can. I think it works perfectly well. Things, though, get a little bit trickier for hand-to-hand combat or close-range combat, because a lot of people want to think that fistfights go down the way that they happen in movies, where two guys stand at long range and they throw kicks and blocks and punches, and that simply isn't accurate. Now, Chad, you were reading a book by a well-trained instructor of Krav Maga, the fighting style of the IDF. And what was the statistic he gave?
I don't know if this was a scientific statistic or not, but it sounded like one from more experience than anything else. Kind of summed up fighting pretty well for me. He said that 90% of fights, fist fights, go to ground, which means that if you get into a fist fight, chances are you and the other guy are going to fall to the ground. One of you is going to be on top, one of you is going to be on the bottom, and the tendency is that the guy on the bottom, he ain't going
to
win.
And thinking back to the fights that I have seen, and Adam thinking back to the fights that he has seen and kind of going around the table like that.
Thinking back to the fights that I have been in?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Same here.
Whether we're talking about the playground, the parking lot, or the pub, they all pretty much go down that way. That assuming you don't get one guy throws a sucker punch and the other guy walks away, if they actually both get into it, two guys jump on each other, start wrestling around, throwing punches and kicks and rolling around. And I don't think the combat rules in most role-playing games really capture that, because they want to treat it as, oh, I'm going to throw my Aikido kick. Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to use this block.
And, well, wait, I rolled my initiative higher than you, so hold still while I kick you.
Yeah, kick you in the face.
I think one of these few significant revisions that D&D 3.5 over 3.0 made was in this area. They added a bunch of grappling stuff. So, like, if you're a bigger character by a couple categories, this happens. You wind up on top of them and kicking the crap out of them.
That is actually, for the monk, though.
Damn, we should have just stole those rules. Why do we write our own?
Well, actually, our rules, they're not the same as, but we did take some pointers from those, and there's some things that definitely our rules are going to have in common with that, because I do like those grappling rules. Yeah. I think certainly there is room for the I throw a punch, you receive a punch, because Adam's sitting at the bar taking a drink. I just walk up and punch him.
Which happens quite often.
It happens all the time.
It does suck.
The day I stop carrying a gun, I'm a dead man. But, there's room in that for the generic attack roll damage. But I don't think most hand-to-hand combat should be like that. And I guess, of course, this depends really on the feel of your role-playing game. If you're doing a role-playing game that is meant to have this high-flying kung fu fighting, probably what we're saying is absolutely going to make no sense for your role-playing game. Keep it the way it is. Do the attack rolls, do the blocks, do the postures, and just handle it the way that you see it.
Run at 120 feet a turn and punch for 12d8 non-subdual and, you know, all the rest.
Jump
Imba,
off the...
Imba! Ember.
No, Imba.
Imba. Oh, Imbal. Okay. I thought you were naming her.
No.
Oh. Oh, my God. They even named her Imba.
Imbalanced.
Oh, my God. You're right. They were drunk. They tried to say Imbal, and they came out with Ember. That's the monk. That's my story now. Sorry, Skip Williams. It's true.
Though moving out of the rough structure of the combat system, this does take us to one of our first big turning points. You have to decide in combat what's right for your game on a sliding scale with pure realism on one end and flair on the other end. Pick what you want. Because if you want something where guys are having blaster fights up and down hallways and they get singed on the shoulders, you want the flair end. If you want to be more realistic, the truth is, you walk around the corner, somebody puts a hollow point into your solar plexus, you're on the ground screaming with a sucking chest wound, or not screaming because you can't with a sucking chest wound, and congratulations, there you are.
Wow, what an exciting game.
And for some games that may make sense.
For a short amount of time, it would be very exciting.
Yeah.
And in fact, for Skies of Glass, we are going to go towards that end, the realism end, because that's the feel of our game. Mm-hmm. But people sitting at home may say, you know what, that's not the feel of my game, so I want to go more towards the flare end or something in the middle. And that's perfectly fine. Just be conscious of that choice and be consistent about it. Yeah. Understand, I guess another way you could put this is to understand, what do you want combat to be like? In Skies of Glass, we want combat to be desperate and fearful. But if you want combat to be wild and swashbuckling and Errol Flynn style or Star Wars style, then you just got to picture that in your head and then write the rules to accomplish that. Something similar is realism versus speed of play. Reality's complicated. Your game?
My game mechanics don't need to be.
Yeah, your game mechanics don't need to be that complicated. Even in a realistic game, your game mechanics don't need to be that complicated. I don't know what to say about that one, just something you got to consider.
That's just a bookkeeping issue. It's, you know, a good way to test that is when you go to do play testing or when you go to do that sort of thing, time how long it takes you to run through the rules. You know, just...
Yeah, and if you really want a mess of rules, there's a game out there called Diablo 2. I love it. It's great. It'd serve your purposes better than a pen and paper game.
If you want to go for the realistic end, be sure to do some real research. Actually pick up some books by guys that have worked in the Army.
Lies.
Or guys that have worked in police. Because I have, looking through a lot of role-playing games, As someone who owns a fair number of guns and who has fired a larger number of guns than I own, including automatic weapons, I can tell you right now, most role-playing game writers either have never touched a gun or did not learn anything from it. And I don't say that to bash role-playing games, because I've seen some games where they're actually pretty dead on, but in a lot of them, they're not. And if you want to be realistic, Schwarzenegger movies are not a good place to begin your research. What your friend told you that a katana can cut through is not a good place to begin your research. So try to find somebody that actually knows what they're talking about, someone that has worked doing police analysis or defense analysis or whatever, and start to get a sense of how these weapons really work and how combat really goes down.
Let's revisit the point of armor and how it should affect whether you get hit or not, or whether damage gets dampened or whatnot or the rest. I think in a high lethality Skies of Glass, let's continue with our current example situation, the skill of the shooter should perhaps have so much more of an effect on whether something will get hit or not than any relevant armor. But armor would dampen impact damage, so you would go with a system like damage thresholds.
Well, that's realistic, which is, I mean, what we're going for. I mean, because I'm wearing a huge metal sheet on my solar plexus doesn't mean that you can't shoot me.
Yeah, exactly.
What I've always been told that good old Gary G was going for when he designed D&D.
Oh my God, Gary has a G too.
He does.
We are rivals.
Was when he had the idea that armor makes it harder to hit you, he was describing it instead as this is modifying your chance of landing a meaningful hit.
Yes.
That if I'm wearing a breastplate that's made out of iron, and the fact of the matter is if I have somebody swinging a club at me, it's no harder to hit me when I'm wearing that breastplate than when it's off. But he may hit me in a way that does not significantly injure me, and therefore we just change the two hit to account for that.
In fact, I've heard a little bit of theory that says if your monster roll as a DM would hit them but doesn't because the armor's high, you should describe in there, oh, well, he lands it on you, but it bounces off your glorious plate chest. Don't you feel good that you bought it?
Seems lacking to me, though, because at some point your armor is going to be so beat to crap from 200 million.
But it's equipment
attrition is another box of worms.
I guess I also try to think, particularly for a modern game, the way a lot of modern armor works, like let's take Kevlar, is you are not deflecting the incoming blow. You're instead trying to spread out the impact area so it becomes manageable.
And you're also stopping the bullet. Yeah, exactly. So you're not stopping the bullet,
right,
so the bullet doesn't enter you.
So if someone's wearing a bulletproof vest and I shoot them with a high caliber hollow point round, they still got hurt by this. They're not dead, probably, but it's not as if, I mean, to put this in D&D terms, instead of doing 2d10 damage, I just did 1 point. But nonetheless, they still took something from it, and I don't think the D&D rules capture that, which for D&D is probably appropriate, but for a modern game or a grittier game, it may not be appropriate, which I guess moves on to the second two ways I could see handling armor, of either you flat-out reduce damage, like my armor always takes 5 points off of incoming hits, or your armor has some kind of a pool of its own, like my armor can take up to 50 points of abuse.
I would see more the former as appropriate. The latter would create a situation of, well, you hit my Kevlar, but I had enough of it to go around, so I'm just going to keep walking.
Yeah, and then after a couple more shots, now suddenly it's gone.
Yes, evaporated under shot three, just disintegrated.
I agree with you.
I hate it when Kevlar does
it's
that.
Not appropriate. Well, it is. It might be appropriate, like energy weapons, some of that are
yeah,
actually
I'm talking
burning away.
I mean projectile bullet on Kevlar or flak armor,
I think that
or something
just goes,
like that.
I think that just goes to prove that when you're designing your game, this is really something you have to consider.
Yeah.
What is the feel of the game? Is it a heroic game or is it not a heroic game? And then what is the realism, even if your game is not realistic, what is the realism that is within the context of your game? I mean, do you have energy weapons that are going to burn off armor? Or is it going to be bullets that are going to beat you up? But the armor is relatively intact, or is it going to be a combination of the two, where you're a knight in shining armor and somebody's hitting you with a sword and you're not really taking much damage from it, but your armor is just getting knocked around?
I think with a real heavy split model like that last one you mentioned, Chad, you approach the tax law handbook, and maybe this is something that's better for a computer game than a tabletop.
Yeah, exactly.
To go back to a old chestnut I haven't used in a while, the rubber has to hit the road somewhere.
Oh my God, it's back!
It's back in all of its glory.
Is there some book that you just pulled into this? I mean, because seriously,
his whole family talks like this. He has two sisters, a brother, and his parents all of them use adages like this, and you know what the scary thing is? They all use different ones.
Communication in your family must take forever.
Actually, it's really quick, because we can boil down such complicated ideas to such simple analogies.
Hi, Mom. What'd you do in school today? Well, the rubber hit the road. Well, that's great. The sun is shining here, too. And then they just both go their merry way.
I'm going to come out with a book called Podcasting Like Dan. That will teach...
Podcasting for Dummies?
Oh! What a feisty today. I don't know what got into us.
Dick.
That's because I've been looking at him across this room for... What time is it? Like 7 hours now?
Eight.
Oh. Time just flies when you're sitting there lusting over me. So.
I've been up for 4 or 5.
Podcasting for Dummies, Dan Reppinger, Chapter 2, The Bedroom Voice.
Yes.
All right, well, getting back to the armor thing, I agree that at some point, even if you want a realistic game, you've just got to back away from it for the sake of allowing the game to progress, because people cannot spend or... probably do not want to spend the whole game session checking sub-rules and consulting charts and pouring back and forth through the rule book. So you got to pick some kind of a simple mechanic and make sure it works. And actually, that latter point is probably worth standing alone as its own point. As you're writing this game, think about how long combat takes and how difficult it will be, particularly for someone who isn't you, who doesn't know what you were thinking. So that may be something you want to put in there.
All right, well, let's move from armor to lethality. At what level of lethality are you putting in your game? How important is this armor to keeping me alive?
Well, and how important is it that people survive combat?
An example, like D&D, low lethality game. Characters are gods.
Super low lethality game.
Characters are gods. They never die.
And if they do, resurrection.
Just bring them back up. Yep. Below 0 hit points, what the hell?
Resurrection
zero
and
level
healing.
Cleric spell will stabilize you, and you'll be back up in a matter of time.
You know, what is the most lethal game you have ever played? Not counting the anything.
Commercial product?
Cthulhu.
Cthulhu is lethal.
Lethal on the matter of people are normal, and the monsters are outrageously
the
powerful.
Monsters are D&D characters.
Yeah.
It's a split system.
I've never played Cthulhu. The most lethal game I have personally played is Shadowrun. That's another one where it is, if you've got the right skills and the right weapons, you can kill a person in a single shot.
And why move away from FASA, having disclaimed that? I'll just go ahead and bring up Battletech. There are certain ways you can oversee the slightest possibility, and your poor butt's dead.
No,
sorry.
You're referring more to Chad's inability to roll saving throws against his life.
Well, I mean, the engine could blow. Your ammo cache
Well, in the mech, yeah, actually, though.
Your cockpit is blown out. You're dead. Sorry.
Mech Warrior is the reverse. It's actually super non-lethal. It takes a lot to kill somebody. We actually, when we played Battletech, used to have to write house rules where we would drop like 50% of a person's damage capacity so you could actually kill them in 2 or 3 shots. It takes a lot to take somebody down.
That's interesting. That's quite a divide.
Speaking of getting killed, let's talk about hit points and injury.
Boo. I don't have any.
No one ever gets injured.
You just boo all of it?
I will never die.
Let's talk about colors. Boo. I hate colors.
Mommy, I want ice cream. It's time for bed. Boo!
Man, now I want ice cream.
Me too.
That sounds pretty good. Let's go get ice cream after the show.
All right.
We can get it on the way to the party. But getting back to the damage in a role-playing game, games like D&D use the hit point model. You have a big, broad pool that represents your ability to withstand damage. As you get hit, it goes down. I've heard some people try to argue that for their game, it's not actually hit points. It's more your luck, that this is just kind of...
Yeah.
Your luck is running out, and eventually you're going to get hurt in a meaningful way. One of the things I like about this system, it's very quick. It's very easy. It allows games like D&D that are supposed to have that sort of fantasy flair to run very well. The downside to it is it has always annoyed me that if you have 100 hit points, you function the exact same at 100 hit points and 1. There is no middle ground. There's fine and dead. Those are the two states of your character. The opposite is injuries. Whereas you get hit, you actually try to resolve, okay, I was hit, that did something to my arm, and this is how it affects my character. I guess a middle system to this would be something like they did in Shadowrun, where you have a kind of a set of hit points. It was 10 for every character. But as those went down, you never described any specific injuries, but nonetheless, as that pool of 10 points drain, things happen to you. You start getting penalties to rolls, and your character started slowing down, and the injuries at least did have some kind of an impact on your overall performance as a character.
I like that because it's realistic.
I like location-specific injury because it's in Deus Ex. I mean, because it provides for realistic applications.
detailed attack rules. This is probably a bigger one in modern games, but could also come up in fantasy games. Within a fantasy game, I would phrase this as something like taking a sword, stabbing, slashing. These are all different things. In modern rules, I talk about auto fire, recoil, knockback. Adding all this stuff in, it adds to the complexity of the rules, which is both good and bad. It's going to make your game a little bit longer to play because there are a lot more special rules to follow. But it adds some kind of interesting variety and gives you a little bit of flexibility. The other thing you got to be careful of is it starts to kind of expose deficiencies in the realism, because the more of these you pile on, the more questions you're raising about the way you chose to handle things. I think ultimately you've got to make some kind of a decision of just how much of this do you want in the game, understanding that, like I said, it adds flexibility, but also adds complexity.
In terms of balancing this combat, Dan, would you like to explain to people the conclusion we came up with earlier? Try and tell me to introduce this topic. Get out of here.
To explain that to you folks at home, we said, hey, Adam, when you get to this topic, why don't you introduce it?
So I'll save you, Adam. I'll bail you out. We wound up comparing the characters to nouns and the combat rules to verbs, and we really established that by the time you got to the verbs, the game was already played. You determined how it was going to go down up the river. It's just a matter of plug and chug. The old Muhammad Ali, the fight takes place in the gym, not the boxing ring. That's just a dance or whatever.
Yeah, because what we were thinking about was when we talked about character creation, we talked a fair amount about game balance, and we talked about character advancement. We talked about game balance. So on Knee Jerk, we wanted to talk about game balance within the combat rules. But like John just said, what we quickly found is there is some game balance in the combat rules, but if you have people that enter the combat field already fairly well balanced, like he's saying with the Muhammad Ali statement that the fight takes place more on the training wheels than it does in the actual boxing ring, your combat's probably balanced. We kept wanting to not accept that. We kept wanting to find somewhere where we could talk about balancing combat rules, and we came up with little things like if you allow sword slashes to have some unusual property that magic fireballs don't, then maybe the guy with the sword suddenly becomes the one who dominates combat.
But even that is almost equipment balance, which is character balance, which is
character
back
creation.
To where we were, character creation, yeah. I think you can use combat rules in and of themselves to adjust the lethality, like we were talking earlier. It's through that that you capture the feel of, well, I'm going to die right now, or I can take 10 rounds without blinking.
I think a lot of this stems from where you start, too. We started at character creation, we made sure it was balanced there, and then as we moved on, everything else just kind of fell in the line. But I could see big problems arising with, you start at combat.
That's true.
You come and up. Then go out from there.
You balance the character classes or roles or whatever you're going to go with to exactly fit this niche, and that niche in the combat scheme. We might have done that accidentally in the character creation process. Maybe it is all just the same show from one angle or another.
Well, I know without a doubt. A lot of the things that we have said and a lot of things that we have experienced comes from the order in which we have developed these things. That if you were to approach this with a different intention and start at a radically different point, I have to think that some of the rules of making a good game would say the same, but many of them you'd find rearranging themselves based on how you approach the game itself. And I guess we knew that, we even expressed that at a few points, that when we created this game, we knew there were some points where you could start at this or that, and we even actually mentioned that throughout the game design series. I think in the end, we picked a pretty solid way of doing this.
I think that's just how we think from characters to fighting, though. I mean, think of all the player's handbooks you've ever read. Who has combat rules before they have character classes? Doesn't happen.
That's actually something Ryan was pointing out on a design blog of his, Ryan Dancy, that is, was he was saying that he suggested for when you're designing a role-playing game, to always put character creation first. Because when people pick up the product in the gaming store, probably the first thing they notice is the art or concept. But as soon as they open that book, one of the first things they're looking for is, okay, what can I be? What can I play?
Yeah, and let's go back to the World of Darkness. It's
I
not
know, I was
lethal
just
combat
thinking that.
World of Darkness. It's, do I want to be a monster? Do I want to be a fairy? Do I want to be a vampire?
You pick the rule book up, none of that's in there. You get the you get the character creation rules and the basic game rules first, and then you've got to go figure out what you want to be.
Really?
Just
so
the
they do it backwards. How about that? Well, when we make Chad the travesty, we can have a system to look back
Chad
on to.
Chad the travesty.
What would one do in this game?
What wouldn't one
cool.
do?
Yes. Yeah, because strong, powerful, handsome. It's a totally imbalanced system.
Because the World of Darkness main book is just rules. There's no character. There's no vampire stuff, no werewolf stuff in there. You've got to get that separate.
Wow. Do you think most people go for the... Well, this is an industry question. You wouldn't know. I wouldn't know. I wonder if people pick their monster first and then think, well, this could be a cool rule system for it.
I bet you anything they do, they probably do buy the vampire book
first. Because
I mean, absolutely
they probably pick their monster before they pick the hobby of role-playing.
Because the monster...
Yeah.
Oh, we actually have a story about that.
We do?
Do you remember this, Mike? A friend of ours we used to game with walked into a bookstore. And there was a guy sitting there reading the werewolf book, Werewolf the Apocalypse or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he was sitting there flipping through it. And this friend of ours walks over and sits down with him and says, oh, hey, I see you're reading the werewolf yet. And he said, yeah, I can't figure out which kind of werewolf I am. And he says, oh, okay, that's cool. You've got an upcoming game, so you're trying to figure out which werewolf to be in here yet. And he's like, oh, well, he starts telling about the different tribes and such. And this guy's like, well, I'm not really sure because my power hasn't manifested yet.
Oh my God.
And we keep, this friend's still like, oh, so you just started the campaign. No. He's like, oh.
But this is like the vampire board that I turned you onto. There's this web ring of, there's this like forum where people really think they're vampires and they go on this forum and have all these conversations about.
It's part of that emo kid movement. It's just one particularly theatrical and stupid manifestation of a greater monster.
And then they go out and play LARP.
Yeah, they do. Another tentacle of the same monster, LARPing.
That's right.
Get us back on topic.
Wow.
I still
John
think.
At Fear the Boot.
So he's like punishing himself. He's like the little kid where they put themselves in the corner after they've misbehaved.
It's not punishment, it's pride.
At some point, maybe for like our 1 year anniversary episode, we have to do a crossover show with Gamer the Podcasting just because. Anyway.
Don't get ugly.
Yes.
Getting back.
I get shot. Bring your gun.
Getting this back on subject. Within Skies of Glass, we have said many times we want these rules to be gritty and fairly realistic. We accept they won't be perfectly realistic, but we want to be close. And we also are still using the tiers. So the complexity is all of the above. We will both have a completely streamlined game and a very detailed chart-heavy game. The question is, which one do you want to play? And just to give a few specifics on these, we have chosen to use injury over hit points. We think it is far more descriptive to say that a person was shot and has suffered some kind of direct effect from that than just draining a pool.
Well, you mean when you shoot somebody, numbers just don't leak out of their body onto the
blood
floor?
Blood leaks out, not numbers. We have also chosen for armor to simply reduce a flat number off the incoming damage, which we think will work sufficiently for what we're trying to do. We will probably add some different rules for, like, knockback and auto fire and stuff. Haven't thought about this too much. We want them in there. One thing we didn't talk about, and actually just thought of now, Skies of Glass, is the initiative check. Within most games, you just roll some number of dice. You might have a modifier to it. And off that, you calculate initiative number, just simply who goes first, the action order. Depending on the game, you either get one action, or like in the D20 system, you may get some combination of complex and simple actions that you can use to describe what you're doing in the round. With Skies of Glass, we decided to do something that I have not seen used in too many games. I have seen it, but not many times, where you are going to take either an attribute or a derived attribute, rolls some kind of random die and add it to it. So maybe like, let's say, your awareness plus 1d6. Come up with a number. And now, every action you take is going to reduce that number. So let's say I'm fighting Adam, and Adam rolls a 15 initiative, and I roll a 10 initiative. So at his 15, he may say, okay, I'm going to draw a gun. And we say, okay, well, that's 1 or 2 points off your chart. So you're now down to a 13 or a 14. He says, okay, I'm going to shoot Dan now. So that takes him down to, let's say, a 9. He misses me, so now it's my turn at a 10. And you just keep doing this downward between the people that are sitting around the board until eventually everyone's out of actions. The downside to this is in large groups could get a little harder to keep track of. I think individually it's not going to be that big a deal, but if you have like a 20-man brawl, this is going to be hard to keep track of. And so we, within the Tier 1 rules, are going to offer the option of using a more traditional initiative system where you just roll your dice and whoever goes highest goes first.
You know how many times we've fought today, Dan?
I know.
Every single example has been Dan attacks Adam, Adam attacks Dan.
I know. Adam and I.
They grapple each other on the floor. Adam breaks Dan's head open on the concrete.
We have had, there's been more simulated conflict between Dan and Adam in the past 8 hours than there has been between the U.S. and USSR in the entirety of the 1980s. It's a shocking number.
It is.
Who wants to play some NATO versus Warsaw Pact after the podcast actually, once we start drinking?
That analogy was a little more shocking than the number of combat simulations that has happened.
That's because you're not a child of the 80s.
Actually, I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Yeah,
he was a child in the 80s.
Oh, I was born mid-80s.
Huh. So, Sky's a Glass Q&A for the day. A guy on our forums by the name of Mirage333 wanted to know when in the series we were going to talk about combat. Mirage, the answer is about 30 minutes ago. So, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
We're so clever.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.